In June 2008, Obama railed against credit card companies. This has to stop. We cannot let the rules of the game continue to be rigged against ordinary Americans. We need a president who will look out for the interests of hardworking families, not just their big campaign donors and corporate allies. Immediately after the speech, he headed to a campaign fundraiser at the Manhattan headquarters of Credit Suisse, one of the major investment companies caught up in the subprime lending debacle. In March 2009, Obama assailed the corporate bonuses handed out by bailout recipient AIG, which had been approved by his own hand-picked Treasury Secretary and AIG bailout architect Tim Geithner. But let's not get distracted. Obama blamed the system and culture that made them possible, a culture where people made enormous sums of money, taking irresponsible risks that have now put the entire economy at risk. The irresponsible risk takers at AIG donated $104,332 to Barack Obama in the 2008 federal election cycle. Since 2004, AIG has donated 60% of its $2.6 million in political donations to Democrats. Obama kept the corrupted cash. But I digress. We don't need these house of cards, these Ponzi schemes, even when they're legal, where relatively few do spectacularly well while the middle class loses ground, Obama inveighed. I want to describe to you the kind of economy that we want to build, an economy that rewards hard work and responsibility, not high-flying finance schemes. He vowed to make sure we don't find ourselves in this situation again, where taxpayers are on the hook for losses in bad times, and all the wealth generated in good times goes to those who are at the very top of the income ladder. That's the kind of ethic we've had for too long. That's the kind of approach that led us into this mess. However, a close look at the high-flying financiers whom Barack the Commoner has surrounded himself with in Washington shows how deeply embedded the ethic of greed is in Obama world. The Wall Street gamblers that Obama and his wife carped about on the campaign trail were shoveling money to his campaign hand over fist. According to the Center for Responsive Politics, hedge funds and private equity firms donated $2,992,456 to the Obama campaign in the 2008 cycle. Obama, erstwhile critic of the campaign finance practice known as bundling, happily accepted more than $200,000 in bundled contributions from billionaire hedge fund manager James Torrey, more than $100,000 in bundled contributions from billionaire hedge fund manager Paul Tudor Jones, and more than $50,000 in bundled contributions from billionaire hedge fund manager Kenneth C. Griffin, chief executive officer of Citadel Investment Group in Chicago. No fewer than 100 Obama bundlers are investment CEOs and brokers. Nearly two dozen work for financial giants such as Lehman Brothers, Goldman Sachs, or Citigroup. By comparison, multi-house dweller and evil Republican rich guy John McCain received $1,699,525 from the industry. That's over 40% less than Obama took. Now the hedge fund managers, status bankers, corporate lobbyists, and lax regulators Obama incessantly cursed are the same ones whom he has appointed to fix the system and culture they created, and from which they all profited greatly. We can't afford 8 more years, or 4 more years, or 1 more year of the failed economic policies that George Bush has put in place, Obama proclaimed on the campaign trail. But just like George Bush, Barack Obama is relying on Goldman Sachs Wall Street power brokers to engineer massive government interventions to rescue failing businesses with the tax dollars of ordinary Americans. Obama had assailed John McCain for being in cahoots with CEOs and hedge fund managers. How are the myriad public-private partnerships Obama has embraced between government and corporate interests any different? Larry, the hedge fund manager. In the final weeks of the 2008 election season, the man of the people met his match. Campaigning in Ohio, Barack Obama came upon Joe Wurzelbacher, who had been playing football with his son in his front yard. "Your new tax plan is going to tax me more, isn't it?" the plumber asked the candidate. "It's not that I want to punish your success," Obama replied. "I just want to make sure that everybody who is behind you, that they've got a chance at success, too." My attitude is that if the economy's good for folks from the bottom up, it's going to be good for everybody. If you've got a plumbing business, you're going to be better off. If you've got a whole bunch of customers who can afford to hire you. And right now, everybody's so pinched that business is bad for everybody. And I think when you spread the wealth around, it's good for everybody. The McCain campaign seized on Obama's wealth redistribution gospel. The videotaped confrontation between Obama and Wurzelbacher went viral on YouTube and was invoked in a presidential debate. Obama lashed back. At a late October 2008 rally in Richmond, Virginia, Obama snarked, "I had a nice conversation the other day with Joe the plumber. Joe's cool. I got no problems with Joe. All I want to do is give Joe a tax cut. But let's be clear who Senator McCain's fighting for. He's not fighting for Joe the plumber. He's fighting for Joe the hedge fund manager. John McCain likes to talk about Joe the plumber, but he's in cahoots with Joe the CEO." A month later, Obama appointed Lawrence Summers, let's call him Larry the hedge fund manager, as director of the White House National Economic Council. Yes, Obama is in cahoots with the King of Wall Street. Summers, an academic economist turned Clinton Treasury official turned Harvard University president, gained notoriety in 2005 after feminists protested his remarks on how women might not have the same genetic ability as men in the sciences and engineering. He was drummed out of academia in a ridiculous hissy fit of political correctness. But the episode had a multi-million dollar silver lining. Summers landed on his feet at New York City-based D.E. Shaw, one of the world's largest hedge funds. Between late 2006 and late 2008, he worked there one day a week for 2 years, providing private consultations and serving as a sounding board for Shaw's traders. In 2008, he earned nearly $5.2 million working for the $30 billion hedge fund management company. One day a week. The New York Times provided a glimpse of his schmooze-filled work life. In addition to his salary at Shaw, Mr. Summers enjoyed growing wealth through investments in the firm's funds. Unlike most hedge funds, which lost money as the markets plunged in 2008, Shaw posted returns of about 7% in its so-called macroeconomic fund. When investors rushed en masse to withdraw their money from hedge funds last year, Shaw asserted its right to block redemptions from its fund. An exception was made for Mr. Summers, however, because the White House job he was taking required him to divest. A spokesman for Shaw said Mr. Summers' main job was not to act as a salesman, but in the fall of 2007, as the financial crisis simmered, Mr. Summers traveled to Dubai for a series of meetings with Shaw's marketing staff and potential investors. Bankers from across the region flew in for the event. Mr. Summers spoke at several lavish dinners and met with local parties involved in Shaw's real estate investments in the area, people briefed on his trip said. Last September, Mr. Summers explained to Shaw traders what appeared to be an aberration in a key interest rate, the London Interbank Offered Rate, or LIBOR, thus helping its traders avoid losses. He spoke at the firm's 20th anniversary gathering for its investors and at a prominent hedge fund investor conference in Boston weeks before the presidential election. In December, he attended the firm's annual holiday party held in the American Museum of Natural History in New York beneath a giant model of a blue whale. Summers also remained on the faculty at Harvard University. In Beltway business-as-usual form, the Obama White House minimized press attention by performing a late Friday afternoon document dump disclosure of Summers' financial assets forms. The record showed that in addition to his massive hedge fund salary and $590,000 in Harvard pay, Summers reaped nearly $2.8 million in speaking fees from many of the major financial institutions and government bailout recipients he now polices, including J.P. Morgan, Citigroup, Goldman Sachs, and Lehman Brothers. A single speech to Goldman Sachs in April 2008 brought in $135,000. A Nigerian media conglomerate, Leaders and Company Limited, shelled out $225,000 to hear Summers speak at an October 2008 gig. A week after Election Day 2008, Summers spoke to Merrill Lynch for $45,000. A week and a half after that, Obama appointed Larry, the hedge fund manager, to his top economic advisory post, circumventing the Senate confirmation vetting process. Summers donated the Merrill Lynch speaking fee to charity. but whatever highly sought-after advice and counsel he gave the failing company was non-refundable. On the side, Summers made $34,000 in spare change writing a column for the Financial Times, weighing in weeks before Election Day on the $700 billion bailout that he was undoubtedly being paid to speak about to clients. Nice work if you can get it. Summers has experience negotiating government-sponsored bailouts that benefit private concerns. In 1995, he spearheaded a $40 billion Mexican peso bailout that bypassed Congress. Summers personally leaned on the International Monetary Fund to provide nearly $18 billion for the package. His boss, then Secretary of the Treasury Robert Rubin, was former co-chairman of Wall Street giant Goldman Sachs, the Mexican government's investment banking firm of choice. Rubin had personally lobbied former Mexican President Carlos Salinas de Gortari to allow Goldman to handle the privatization of Telefones de México, the multinational Monitor financial newsletter reported. Rubin also shepherded the $2.3 billion global public offering of mega media television company Grupo Televisa. Rubin acknowledged in his financial disclosure forms that he had Goldman Sachs clients with whom he had had significant contact, including six powerful Mexican clients. The public sector clients were the Mexican government, Mexico's finance ministry, and Mexico's central bank. The private sector clients were Telefonos de México, Cemex S.A., the largest cement firm in the Americas, and Desk Sociedad de Fomento Industrial, Mexico's seventh largest manufacturing conglomerate. Rubin reaped $25 million in compensation from Goldman Sachs and Company in 1992 alone. In 1997, the Clinton administration announced with great fanfare that Mexico had repaid $12.6 billion in loans. Clinton, Rubin, and Summers openly joked about how the Treasury Secretary had profited. The New York Times captured the jubilation. The usually understated former investment banker was clearly reveling in the success of the bailout today. In the Roosevelt Room at the White House, Mr. Clinton sidestepped a question about a recent decline in the value of the peso and deferred to Mr. Rubin, explaining, "You've made so much more money than I have." "There is a point to that," said Mr. Rubin, who usually makes no references, even in jest, to his huge fortune. Back at the Treasury later in the day, Mr. Rubin raised an eyebrow when his deputy, Lawrence H. Summers, who was the first to recognize the possible ripple effects of the crisis in emerging markets and who organized much of the loan effort, joked that he would settle for just 1% of the Treasury's $580 million profit on the deal. "Larry, anything you can negotiate, I'm happy to split with you," Mr. Rubin shot back. Not everyone was so jovial and sanguine about the moral hazard the Summers-Rubin bailout created. GOP Congressman James Leach of Iowa, chairman of the House Banking Committee, warned that great caution is going to have to be exercised in assuming that this is the only or best way to proceed. American taxpayers cannot be placed disproportionately in jeopardy as the world's lender of last resort. More than a decade later, Summers was back in D.C., helping guide another Democrat administration down the road to bailout hell. Perhaps that explains why he was caught literally napping not once but twice at economic summits hosted by President Obama. At a fiscal responsibility summit in late February 2009 and at a meeting with credit card CEOs in mid-March 2009, photographers captured Summers slumbering while bureaucrats and businessmen collaborated on creating new taxpayer pipelines to prop up failing enterprises. "Been there, done that, zzzz." Some liberal journalists and bloggers did try and wake up the public to Summers' role in helping engineer the current fiscal meltdown while he served as Clinton Treasury Secretary. It was Summers, as much as anyone, who in the Clinton years prevented the regulation of the hedge funds that are at the center of the explosion of the derivatives bubble, and the fact that D.E. Shaw, a leading hedge fund, paid the Obama advisor $5.2 million last year does suggest a serious conflict of interest, Robert Scheer wrote in The Nation. The left-leaning ProPublica online investigative journalism website explained that in 1998, an obscure federal agency, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, raised the prospect of regulating the burgeoning market in complex financial instruments. Who led the charge against such oversight? The nation's leading financial officials, Securities and Exchange Commission Chairman Arthur Levitt, Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan, Secretary of the Treasury Robert Rubin and his deputy Lawrence Summers, pummeled the proposal, saying it was dangerous to even discuss the idea. Double standards, anyone? Scheer acknowledged them. If this was happening in a Republican administration, scores of Democrats in Congress would be all over it, asking tough questions about what exactly did Summers do to earn all that money from the D.E. Shaw hedge fund. As it is, with their silence, they are complicit in this emerging scandal of the banking bailout. Another epiphany hit Washington Post blogger Dan Frumkin. It's become increasingly clear over the last several months that despite the Obama administration's generally progressive economic views and sporadic bouts of populist rhetoric, the White House has something of a soft spot for Wall Street. You don't say. Timmy, the tax-cheating, bailout-bungling bureaucrat. They call Tim Geithner an indispensable whiz kid and wonder boy. They are the bipartisan establishmentarians in Washington. Geithner's mentor, President George W. Bush's Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson, called him a very unusually talented young man who understands government and understands markets. Geithner's longtime mentor and tennis camp partner Larry Summers affectionately calls him Young Tim. GOP Senator Orrin Hatch declared him a very competent guy. Democrat Senator Harry Reid concurred. Tim Geithner is exactly the man for the job. From his time as the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York and in leadership roles at the Treasury Department, IMF, and the Council on Foreign Relations, Mr. Geithner knows how to navigate the complex financial world. Announcing Geithner's nomination as Treasury Secretary on November 24, 2009, President Obama hailed the genius civil servant as uniquely qualified. With stellar performances and outstanding results at every stage of his career, Tim has earned the confidence and respect of business, financial, and community leaders, members of Congress, and political leaders around the world, and I know he will do so once again as America's next Treasury Secretary, the chief economic spokesman for my administration. Golden Boy seemed to have it all. The Dartmouth and Johns Hopkins educated president of the New York Federal Reserve Bank had studied Japanese and Chinese and had lived in East Africa, India, Thailand, China, and Japan. His father ran the Ford Foundation's Asian grants and once crossed paths with Obama's mother, who worked on developing Ford programs for Indonesia. Geithner's maternal grandfather was an advisor to President Dwight D. Eisenhower. But all the public service pedigrees and Ivy League degrees in the world couldn't save him from basic tax-cheating stupidity. In mid-January 2009, before his confirmation hearing, the Senate Finance Committee discovered that Geithner had failed to pay some $43,000 in federal self-employment taxes for 4 separate years and only coughed up $26,000 of that debt when he was named Obama's Treasury Secretary-designate in November 2009. Somehow brilliant and meticulous Geithner didn't catch the lapses. Recall that Joe the Plumber, an average guy with no Ivy League degrees in business or finance, was crucified for his $1,200 Ohio tax lien. The state had sent a notification to a prior residence he had vacated. One might give a common man some leeway for making common mistakes, but Tim Geithner, as all his cheerleaders in Washington reminded us, is no common man. The Obama-Geithner defense, $43,000 in unpaid taxes is a common occurrence, simply is not a credible alibi. Nor was his sheepish admission during his Senate confirmation hearings that he used TurboTax to prepare his taxes. Supporters dubbed Geithner too big to fail. Try too smart to care. In addition to his failure to pay 4 years worth of federal taxes, you try getting away with that without getting thrown behind bars. Geithner also illegally employed an immigrant maid for 3 months after her work authorization papers had expired. But wait, that wasn't all. Geithner's employer at the time of his serial tax dodging was the International Monetary Fund. The agency reimburses its employees for their self-employment taxes. The allowance was made to keep IMF and World Bank worker salaries on par with other foreign peers. IMF employees receive an employee tax manual outlining their obligations. Maybe if it were written in Japanese or Chinese, Geithner would have paid closer attention. Employees also file an annual tax allowance request promising to pay the taxes for which I have received tax allowance payments. The Senate Finance Committee released one of those forms signed by Geithner. A Senate source confirmed to National Review's Byron New York that Geithner pocketed the cash. He was getting the money. He was being paid a tax allowance to pay him for tax payments that he should have made but had not. IRS employment application packets notify potential workers that the Treasury Inspector General for Tax Administration vets all candidates and current employees who have violated or are violating laws, rules, or regulations related to the performance of their duties. Obama stood by his nominee, who would oversee the IRS, but might not even qualify for a lesser job at the agency. Obama spokesman Robert Gibbs calls Geithner's transgressions honest mistakes. Media outlets like the Associated Press attempted to downplay his snubbing of the law as mere tax goofs. When Democrats like Geithner, Al Franken, and Charlie Rangel fail to pay up what they legally owe, they're just goofs. When you or I object to forking over more than what we're already paying, Vice President Joe Biden calls us unpatriotic. The condescension toward ordinary Americans incensed by Geithner's tax evasion was bipartisan. These are not the times to think in small political terms, Senator Lindsey Graham, a South Carolina Republican, sniffed. He has a great resume. No, Senator Graham, he does not. Left out of the glowing endorsements, Geithner's disastrous track record while working at the IMF in the 1990s. Former Australian Prime Minister and Labour Party leader Paul Keating blasted Geithner for botching Indonesia's economic troubles. Tim Geithner was the Treasury line officer who wrote the IMF, International Monetary Fund, program for Indonesia in 1997 and 1998, which was to apply current account solutions to a capital account crisis. The Sydney Morning Herald explained the debacle. In other words, Geithner fundamentally misdiagnosed the problem, and his misdiagnosis led to a dreadfully wrong prescription. Geithner thought Asia's problem was the same as the ones that had shattered Latin America in the 1980s, and Mexico in 1994, a classic current account crisis. In this kind of crisis, the central cause is that the government has run impossibly big debts. The solution? The IMF, the Washington-based emergency lender of last resort, will make loans to keep the country solvent, but on condition the government hacks back its spending. The cure addresses the ailment. But the Asian crisis was completely different. The Asian governments that went to the IMF for emergency loans, Thailand, South Korea, and Indonesia, all had sound public finances. The problem was not government debt, it was great tsunamis of hot money in the private capital markets. When the wave rushed out, it left a credit drought behind. But Geithner, through his influence on the IMF, imposed the same cure the IMF had imposed on Latin America and Mexico. It was the wrong cure. Geithner fared no better as president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, a position he attained thanks to heavy lobbying by his Wall Street mentors Robert Rubin and Larry Summers, both of whom sat on the New York Fed's selection committee. Their cronyism had multi-billion-dollar consequences for taxpayers. Rubin, you see, was also an executive at New York-based Citigroup, which Geithner regulated, or was supposed to regulate. Instead, he helped foster Citi's spending binge and engineered the teetering company's $52 billion federal bailout. An investigation by ProPublica found that the New York Fed, under Geithner, had lifted some restrictions on Citigroup, allowing it to engage in risky ventures with insufficient capital. In response to questions from the Senate Finance Committee about his failure to police Citigroup, Geithner acknowledged, "Citigroup supervisors, including the Federal Reserve, failed to identify a number of their risk management shortcomings and to induce appropriate changes in behavior." He called his own initiatives to strengthen the financial system ahead of the crisis inadequate. Geithner had a hand in the $30 billion Bear Stearns bailout and the multi-level AIG bailouts, $85 billion and $38 billion under President Bush, and another $30 billion in March 2009 under Obama. Handsome sums of that taxpayer money went to major financial institutions that had employed Obama's money men and their closest confidants. Goldman Sachs, for example, raked in nearly $13 billion in December 2009 from AIG and federal TARP or TARP funds. It is money the company's chief financial officer said he did not need or expect. Those who saw Geithner work up close provided the most damning criticisms. Aaron Ross Sorkin reported in the New York Times Deal Book page that behind the scenes, Mr. Geithner was the point person for weeks of sleep-deprived bailout weekends. It was Mr. Geithner, not Mr. Paulson, for example, who put together the original rescue plan for the American International Group, said one executive who attended several confidential meetings on the bailouts. He was in the room at every turn of the crisis. You can look at that both ways. In other words, Geithner's intellectual DNA is embedded in these failed financial rescues. Failed and inadequate, in his own words. Superfluous and harmful in the eyes of many on Wall Street. And yet senators on both sides of the political aisle lavished praise on his great resume before installing him as the next bank-beholden bureaucrat to steer Barack Obama's savior-based economy. By March 2009, Geithner had become a running national joke, eliciting scorn in the conservative blogosphere after announcing he would be chasing after international tax deadbeats while he was a tax deadbeat himself, and evoking snickers from Capitol Hill over his inability to fill top slots at the Treasury. The conservative New York Post editorial board remarked on the irony of tax cheat Geithner testifying before the House Ways and Means Committee on tax cheat Charlie Rangel, Democrat congressman from New York, on how to reduce tax evasion and avoidance. Meanwhile, the liberal Huffington Post reported that lawmakers and congressional staff on both sides of the aisle laughed in disbelief at a briefing on Geithner's latest financial rescue plan. The laughter was at its height when Obama officials explained that the White House plan to guarantee a wide swath of toxic assets, which they referred to as legacy assets, but wouldn't be asking Congress for money, the site noted. Representative Brad Sherman, Democrat California, a bailout opponent in the fall, asked the officials to give Congress the total dollar figure for which they were on the hook. The officials said that they couldn't provide a number, a response met by chuckling that was bipartisan but tilted toward the GOP side. Soon after, the grand kabuki theater of outrage erupted over AIG bonuses that Geithner had approved. Geithner claimed he didn't find out about the AIG bonus issue until March 10, 2009. This was contradicted by AIG President Edward Liddy's testimony a week earlier. Liddy was right. Geithner was wrong. A House hearing broadcast on C-SPAN on March 3rd showed Geithner being questioned directly about the bonuses a full week before Geithner's claims he was made aware of the impending controversy. Geithner probably wished he had lost his appointment book on February 10, 2009, when he unveiled his vaunted vague financial stability plan on Capitol Hill. In stark contrast to the love fest at his confirmation hearing, senators openly mocked the not-so-golden boy. "So you have no clue," retorted Senator Lindsey Graham, who only a few months ago chastised Geithner's critics for playing gotcha and engaging in small politics. The Dow dropped 382 points after Geithner's big fail. A month later, Geithner caused the dollar to decline in international trade after he suggested at a major forum that the United States was quite open to a suggestion from Chinese officials to move to a new global currency. Former Clinton Treasury colleague Roger Altman tried to rescue Geithner from his blunder with painful prompting. "I'd like to ask one final question, in effect, on behalf of the market. It might be useful if you try to clarify your earlier comment on the reaction to the central bank governor of China's idea." But by the time Geithner took the hint, it was too late. It was actually the second time Geithner had roiled the markets with public comments about China. In January 2009, during his confirmation hearings, his suggestion that China was manipulating its currency resulted in a sharp sell-off of U.S. bonds, in which China has a large stake. He came right out and said Obama believes China is manipulating their currency, Marianne Hurley, a bond market strategist, told the Wall Street Journal. "It's very easy to pick another country to be your whipping boy." In an era where we're looking at deficits as far as the eye can see, what we don't need is somebody starting to dump our debt. The Wall Street Journal's market beat reporter David Gaffin pleaded with Geithner, "Will you please be quiet? Please." By May 2009, the whiz kid was the nation's whipping boy. Geithner had the eyes of a shoplifter, a cable TV talking head cracked. Think Bambi looking into the headlights on an 18-wheeler, quipped veteran risk analyst Christopher Whalen to Portfolio.com reporter Gary Weiss. Treasury Department vacancies and key policy decisions piled up as a result of what the Washington Post called Treasury's ad hoc management, ruled by Geithner's unofficial advisors. In over his head was the new conventional wisdom. White House Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel swooped in at President Obama's urging, according to the Wall Street Journal, to bail out the bailout king. Emanuel has been so involved in the workings of the Treasury that Rahm wants it has become an unofficial mantra among some at the Treasury, according to government officials, the paper reported. But well before he set foot in office, clear-eyed critics had pegged Geithner for a career bureaucrat, buoyed by the Wall Street Old Boys Network with a track record of misreading financial crises, pandering to failing banks, and playing fast and loose with his taxes. It's not like Washington hadn't been warned. In cahoots with Citicorp. By late November 2008, taxpayers came to expect midnight bailouts from feckless feds in cahoots, to borrow our president's words, with big business. At 1 a.m. Eastern on November 24, 2008, Citicorp got its share of the bailout pie, $306 billion in government backing and $20 billion from the TARP banking bailout rammed through Congress a month earlier. The Citi rescue was the result of intense collaboration between Citigroup board member and former Clinton Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin, then Bush Secretary of Treasury Henry M. Paulson, Jr., and then President of the Federal Reserve Bank of the New York Paulson Rubin protege, soon-to-be Obama Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner. Is it too much to ask Washington to develop a policy that isn't crafted in a scramble of private phone calls? An exasperated Wall Street Journal editorial board wondered the next day. In January 2009, the Obama administration flexed its faux populist muscle in demanding that Citigroup drop its plans to spend $50 million for a luxury French jet. The same month, Rubin resigned from the company, walking away from the wreckage with $150 million after 10 years at the company. Behind the scenes, more Citi men were sitting in the catbird seat. They included Jacob Lew, former chief financial officer of Citigroup Alternative Investments, who was appointed Obama's number two at the Department of State and will oversee interagency economic policy matters, and Michael Froman, another former CFO in the same division, who is now deputy assistant to the president and deputy national security advisor for international economic affairs. Obama and the bonus bashers refrained from demagoguing Lew's $1.1 million plus salary and bonus and Froman's $7.4 million plus salary and 2008 year-end bonus of $2.25 million. Both Lew and Froman now work closely with Wall Street crony and former Robert Rubin co-worker Larry Summers at the National Economic Council. National Journal connected more Rubin Citi dots. Director of the Office of Management and Budget, Peter Orszag, and Summers' deputy, Jason Furman, both served as directors of the Hamilton Project, a Brookings Institution initiative that produces research and policy positions on economic issues where Rubin was a founding member of the Advisory Council. If that isn't enough, Froman served as Rubin's chief of staff during Rubin's stint as Secretary of Treasury. 3 months after the Bush-Obama team engineered the first Citi bailout in November 2008, the Obama administration announced it was raising its stake in the failing company from 8% to 38%. We need a president who will look out for the interests of hardworking families, not just their big campaign donors and corporate allies, candidate Barack Obama insisted in the halcyon days of his campaign. Still waiting. He promised hope, but his Wall Street friends and backers got the change. Billions and billions of dollars worth of change. The subprime gang. Former Fannie Mae corruptocrats Jim Johnson and Franklin Raines may not have official positions with the administration, but other subprime crisis-connected beneficiaries do. Louis Caldera, director of the White House Military Office, earned a hefty six-figure sum for serving on various corporate boards, including $227,155 in board fees and deferred compensation from IndyMac Bank Corp, the California-based savings and loan company that collapsed in 2008. IndyMac was seized by the federal government and investigated by the FBI for subprime loan fraud. Fun fact, Caldera was responsible for freaking out New York City residents in late April 2009 after approving a mission to allow low-flying planes that resembled Air Force One to zoom past the Statue of Liberty for an aerial photo op. City officials were not warned, hundreds of New Yorkers, under the quite reasonable impression that it was a terrorist attack, panicked, and several were hurt in the rush to evacuate their buildings. Obama's close hometown crony, campaign finance chief, and senior advisor Penny Pritzker was head of Superior Bank of Chicago, a subprime specialist that went bust in 2001, leaving more than 1,400 people stripped of their savings after bank officials falsified profit reports. Pritzker's lawyer, Ed O'Melveny and Myers, Tom Donilon, is now deputy national security advisor. He earned just shy of $4 million representing her and other high-profile Meltdown clients, including Yip, Citigroup, and Goldman Sachs. In April 2009, the White House tapped former Fannie Mae executive Donald Remy to be the Army's top lawyer. He submitted a bio that stated that he had worked as a senior vice president for a major U.S. company for an unspecified number of years. The employer was Fannie Mae. He worked there from 2000 to 2006, during the height of the government-sponsored mortgage giant's accounting scandals. Remy wasn't just any low man on the totem pole. Among his job titles at Fannie, according to Congressional Quarterly, Vice President and Deputy General Counsel for Litigation, Senior Vice President and Deputy General Counsel, Senior Vice President and Chief Compliance Officer, and Senior Vice President, Housing and Community Development. When questioned by Republicans in the Senate about these rather glaring omissions on his bio, Remy protested, "My time at Fannie Mae was a time period where I am personally proud of all the work that I did." Omissions speak louder than words. Austin Goolsbee, named head of Obama's Economic Advisory Board, was a champion of extending credit to the uncreditworthy. In a 2007 op-ed for the New York Times, he derided those who called subprime mortgages irresponsible. He preferred to describe them as innovations in the mortgage market to expand the pool of home buyers. Now this wrong-headed academic who espoused government policies that fed the housing-feeding frenzy is in charge of fixing the loose credit mess he advocated. Goolsbee, by the way, is the 15th wealthiest member of the Obama administration, with assets valued between $1,146,000 to $2,715,000. He also pulled in a University of Chicago salary of $465,000 and additional wages and honoraria worth $93,000, according to the Washingtonian. If you've got the right corrections, being wrong pays. Rambo the Rich. White House Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel's most famous dictum is this: Rule 1, never allow a crisis to go to waste. They are opportunities to do big things. Emanuel certainly didn't let the housing crisis go to waste. During the Clinton years, he was appointed to the Freddie Mac Board of Directors at a time when its oversight manager called the quasi-governmental agency so pliant that it enabled rampant bookcooking. Freddie Mac's stock skyrocketed. Its CEOs helped themselves to massive bonuses. Emanuel's hometown paper, the Chicago Tribune, exposed how Emanuel's profitable stint during this corruption-plagued period entailed almost no work. The board met no more than six times a year. Unlike most fellow directors, Emanuel was not assigned to any of the board's working committees, according to company proxy statements. Immediately upon joining the board, Emanuel and other new directors qualified for $380,000 in stock options plus a $20,000 annual fee, records indicate. On Emanuel's watch, the board was told by executives of a plan to use accounting tricks to mislead shareholders about outsized profits the government-chartered firm was then reaping from risky investments. The goal was to push earnings onto the books in future years, ensuring that Freddie Mac would appear profitable on paper for years to come and helping maximize annual bonuses for company brass. The accounting scandal wasn't the only one that brewed during Emanuel's tenure. During his brief time on the board, the company hatched a plan to enhance its political muscle. That scheme, also reviewed by the board, led to a record $3.8 million fine from the Federal Election Commission for illegally using corporate resources to host fundraisers for politicians. Emmanuel was the beneficiary of one of those parties after he left the board and ran in 2002 for a seat in Congress from the north side of Chicago. The board was throttled for its acquiescence to the accounting manipulation in a 2003 report by Armando Falcon Jr., head of a federal oversight agency for Freddie Mac. The scandal forced Freddie Mac to restate $5 billion in earnings and pay $585 million in fines and legal settlements. Freddie lost tens of billions of dollars and cost billions more after both major parties in Washington engineered a gargantuan Fannie-Freddie bailout. The former ballet dancer turned Chicago pole, meanwhile, pirouetted off the Freddie stage and then cashed in again. The Tribune reported that he sold more of his Freddie Mac stock for an easy $100,001 and $250,000. Displaying their continued disregard for their own transparency pledges, White House officials refused to fulfill the newspaper's request for public documents related to Emmanuel's tenure as a Freddie Mac director. The revolving money machine brought Emmanuel a combined $51,000 plus in campaign contributions from Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac when he ran for the House. Chicago Sun-Times columnist Lynn Sweet pointed out that as a member of the same House subcommittee that has oversight of the Fannie-Freddie, Emmanuel, with outstanding options for 2,500 shares of Freddie, had a major conflict of interest. When Emmanuel responded that he put the shares in a trust and would recuse himself from voting on any issues related to Freddie Mac, Sweet shot back, "Emmanuel's trust is supposed to be blind, not stupid." Emmanuel's savvy ability to flit in and out of the government corporate revolving door paid huge dividends. Washingtonian magazine lists him as the fifth wealthiest member of the Obama administration, with assets between $5,023,000 and $13,170,000 in 2007. According to congressional disclosures, Emmanuel made $16.2 million in his 2.5 years as an investment banker at Wasserstein Perella, in between advising Bill Clinton and taking Rod Blagojevich's vacant seat in the 5th District of Illinois, or roughly $740 an hour, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. While Barack and Michelle Obama assailed greedy bankers and hedge fund managers and advised hopeful young followers to stay away from Wall Street, Emmanuel happily absorbed hedge fund cash. OpenSecrets.org reported that Emmanuel was the top House recipient in the 2008 election cycle of contributions from hedge funds, private equity firms, and the larger securities investment industry, with $1.5 million filling his campaign coffers. They only call them ill-gotten gains when the cash is going in somebody else's pocket. Emmanuel cut his teeth in the mega fundraising business under the Daily Machine in Chicago and then under the Clinton Machine in Washington. Goldman Sachs kept Emmanuel on a $3,000 monthly retainer while he worked as Clinton's chief fundraiser, leading Washington Examiner reporter Timothy P. Carney to speculate about whether Goldman may have been funneling money to Clinton's campaign through the back door and the front door. By March of 1992, the heart of that dramatic primary season, Goldman Partners had sent $54,000 to the Clinton campaign. The financial titans threw in another $50,000 to become the Clinton administration's top funder. Emmanuel received nearly $80,000 in cash from Goldman Sachs during his 4 terms in Congress, investments which have reaped untold rewards as Emmanuel assumed a leading role in championing the $700 billion TARP banking bailout law. It's all about nurturing past, present, and future lucrative relationships for Rambo. Perhaps that explains why the fifth wealthiest member of Team Obama chooses to live rent-free in the Washington, D.C. home of close friend Democrat Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro of Connecticut. DeLauro's husband, Stan Greenberg, owns a polling firm employed by an Emmanuel campaign committee and by the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, which Emmanuel headed in 2005 and 2006, the Chicago Tribune reported. Ethics watchdogs raised disclosure and tax liability red flags about the arrangement, but nothing came of the complaints. The revolving door grants immunity to Wall Street's best connected. Louis the Vacuum Cleaner. A Ambassadorships have long been used as patronage rewards for deep-pocketed donors. Clinton did it. Bush did it. And before his first 100 days had passed, Obama embraced business as usual, too. In May 2009, the London Telegraph broke the news that Obama would appoint one of his biggest campaign fundraisers for the post of U.S. Ambassador to Britain. Louis Sussman has no diplomatic experience. But he has buku bucks. The Chicago lawyer and banker, who worked for Salomon Brothers and retired as a Citigroup vice chairman in February 2009, gallivants with the Kennedys and the Careys in Hyannisport and Nantucket. He has raised massive amounts for Democrats since the Carter era. He bundled between $200,000 and $500,000 for Team Obama and is known as the vacuum cleaner and the big bundler for his fundraising prowess. Research indicates that no reporter has ever asked how many homes Sussman owns. The Washington Post's Al Kamen tallied up more ambassadorial candidates from the money pit. Entertainment mogul Charlie Rivkin, who headed up Obama's California fundraising operations, raking in $500,000 for the campaign and another $300,000 for the inaugural, was the leading candidate for a post in France. Boston money man Alan Salamont, who also bundled the same amounts for the campaign and inaugural, was the leading candidate for the ambassadorship in Spain. About one-third of all ambassadorships are political appointees. Barack, the change agent, told the press he would not abandon historical precedent and that it would be disingenuous to commit to anything less. Gary, the Goldman Sachs guy. Yes, another one. It's like another 8 years of failed Bush economic policies all rolled into the first 100 days. In March 2009, the Senate Agriculture Committee approved Goldman Sachs partner Gary Gensler as head of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, despite heated grilling over his role, as Reuters described it, as a high-level Treasury official in a 2000 law that exempted the $58 trillion credit default swap market from oversight. The financial instruments have been blamed for amplifying global financial turmoil. Gensler said, sorry, which worked for Tim Geithner, so why not? Washingtonian magazine named Gensler the wealthiest member of the Obama administration, worth an estimated $15,533,000 to $61,745,000. In announcing his nomination, Obama said Gensler brings a wealth of expertise from both the public and private sectors to this position. Well, he was right about the wealth. Jimmy, the Muni Bond Man. Chicago investment banker James Reynolds raised more than $200,000 for the Obama campaign while chief executive of Loop Capital Markets. The municipal bond specialist was a longtime friend of Obama, fading the rising star in his Hyde Park home and convincing friends and associates to open up their wallets more than a decade ago. In 2003, USA Today reported, Reynolds was caught on FBI wiretaps, arranging what prosecutors called a sham consulting contract with a gal pal of a Philadelphia mayoral advisor. After the conversations, Reynolds snagged $300,000 in no-bid city contracts for Loop Capital Markets. City officials went to jail over the scam. Reynolds skated. The Obama campaign's only statement? Jim Reynolds has admitted that he made mistakes, but he has not been charged with any wrongdoing. Only the highest ethical standards for hope and change. George, the generously paid general counsel. Corporate lawyer George W. Madison worked for retirement management company TIAA-CREF, before the Obama administration tapped him for the general counsel position at the Treasury Department. The firm spent big bucks lobbying in Washington, but Treasury ethics bureaucrats saw no conflict of interest problems. In fact, they approved a deal allowing Madison to collect a government salary of $153,200 while receiving an additional $955,000 next year from TIAA-CREF as part of a corporate buyout. Madison is slated to receive another $1.6 million from TIAA-CREF in 2011 and $333,000 in 2012, according to the Washington Times. Obama officials state blithely that Madison will simply recuse himself from any matters affecting TIAA-CREF. The company, however, has lobbied every corner of the federal government on every major corporate financial issue, ranging from the banking bailout to executive compensation to accounting and securities regulations to mortgage reform and the stimulus. What would be left for Madison to counsel the Treasury Department on? Mark, the corporate lobbyist. There's always room for another Goldman Sachs water carrier in the House of Barack, even if it means breaking Obama's own no-lobbyist rules. In January 2009, Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner chose former Goldman Sachs lobbyist Mark Patterson to serve as his top deputy and overseer of the $700 billion TARP banking bailout, $10 billion of which went to Goldman Sachs. In the understatement of the year, left-leaning government watchdog Melanie Sloan of the Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington responded, "It makes it appear that they are saying one thing and doing another. Give her the Sherlock Holmes Award." Paul Blumenthal of the Sunlight Foundation noted that while at Goldman Sachs, Patterson lobbied against executive pay limits that Obama had crusaded for as senator, before, that is, his administration carved out exemptions for AIG. While Patterson agreed to recuse himself on any Goldman Sachs-related issues or related policy concerns, Blumenthal wrote, "It still creates a serious conflict for Geithner as Treasury is being partly managed by a former Goldman lobbyist." Geithner is also placed in a tough position considering that his chief of staff is limited in the areas in which he can work, supposedly. As if that weren't enough baggage, Washington Examiner columnist Timothy P. Carney reported that Patterson was also a former Tom Daschle acolyte and advisor who carved out a niche in alternative energy mandates and subsidies. He championed an ethanol company firm in Canada, Iogen Corporation, which received $30 million from Goldman Sachs in a bid to boost its green image. The logs started rolling. Iogen soon received an $80 million Bush Energy Department grant and millions more in energy bill set-asides. "So now you see how it works," Carney demonstrated. "A well-connected company invests in a technology that is currently unprofitable. That company then uses its high-dollar lobbyists and friends inside government to subsidize or mandate that product into profitability." Goldman similarly invested in and lobbied for greenhouse gas credits, which are literally worthless without climate change legislation that caps emissions. A good lobbyist is like an alchemist, turning lead into gold. Mark Patterson and Goldman Sachs may not have figured out how to turn switchgrass into energy, but they did figure out how to turn it into profit. Patterson is a rainmaker, leveraging his government connections into private profit. His emblematic of both the green revolution Obama touts and the revolving door Obama assails. Yes, so much for Obama's close the revolving door between K Street and Capitol Hill. So much for ridding Washington and Wall Street of excess greed, excess compensation, excess risk-taking. So much for giving the American people more than window dressing when it comes to ethics reform. It's not that bona fide capitalism is evil or that lawyers, lobbyists, hedge fund managers, or corporate executives should have no role in government. It's the cognitive dissonance. This is the same Obama, remember, who said, "Let's be clear who Senator McCain's fighting for. He's not fighting for Joe the plumber. He's fighting for Joe the hedge fund manager." John McCain likes to talk about Joe the plumber, but he's in cahoots with Joe the CEO. Words. Just words. Words that were, in fact, the reverse of the truth. And, as we'll see, not only do the titans of Wall Street enrich themselves at the house of Obama, but so do the president's fat cat union friends, with the added unctuousness of claiming to save America's workers while screwing them over. Chapter 7, SEIU, Look for the Union Label. Barack Obama donned a purple silk tie for one of his most important campaign speeches in the fall of 2007. "It's time to turn the page on the old way of doing business," he urged the rowdy crowd, extending thanks to Andy and Anna, his Illinois crew, and the rest of his homies. Obama told attendees he was so grateful to them for their unbelievable love and support. It was, he gushed, so good to be among friends. A hyperkinetic Obama adopted the tone, accent, and swagger of a Chicago street preacher at the event, which turned into an unabashed revival meeting as his 40-minute speech progressed. "We look after each other," he shouted. Supporters responded with amens and ahums. with finger jabbing and voice rising, Obama vowed, I will open up the doors of government and ask you to be involved in your democracy again. Audience members interrupted repeatedly with whoops, applause, and standing ovations. Recounting his early years as a community organizer, Obama reminded the crowd that he had walked with them before. I've been there, done that, he boasted, and he would do it again if he needed to as president. The White House is the people's house, he bellowed. It's our time. The crowd went wild. Fired up? Obama asked at the climax of his speech. Fired up, the crowd shouted in response. Ready to go, he hollered. Ready to go, they shouted. Let's go change the world, he exhorted them, and they broke into a deafening chant. Obama! Obama! This was no ordinary reunion of family and friends. The setting was the 1.8 million member Service Employees International Union's Political Action Conference in Washington, D.C. Obama's purple tie was a nod to the spirit color of the labor organization, and his effusive shout-outs went to SEIU's heaviest hitters. Andy is militant left-wing social worker turned union-heavy Andy Stern, who broke off SEIU from the old guard AFL-CIO to consolidate low-skill service workers and create a 21st century labor empire. Anna is Anna Berger, Stern's partner at SEIU. Known as the Queen of Labor, she climbed from welfare caseworker in Pennsylvania to strategist for old guard Union King John Sweeney to the most powerful woman in the labor movement. The Illinois crew, to which Obama referred repeatedly, is SEIU's Local 880, the Chicago chapter of home care and hotel workers, which Obama assisted in his early activist days. The homies Obama personally thanked are Tom Balanoff, Illinois president of SEIU Local 1 with 40,000 janitors and security guards, whom Obama worked with as a community organizer, Keith Kelleher, president of SEIU's Local 880, and Christine Boardman, president of SEIU's Local 73, which represents 25,000 public service workers in Illinois and Indiana. I've spent my entire adult life working with SEIU. I'm not a newcomer to this, Obama bragged, a remark that reporter Mark Ambinder saw as a dig at Democratic rival John Edwards, who had been diligently courting SEIU officials. Obama didn't just promise to walk with SEIU members on picket lines, he vowed to play offense, to reclaim the Bush administration's Labor Department for big labor. We're gonna take it back. And to deliver a radical legislative agenda pushed by the unions. Obama promised to pass universal health care by the end of my first term, and the Orwellian titled Employee Free Choice Act, EFCA, to do away with private ballot union elections in the workplace. In 2007, he co-sponsored EFCA, also known as card check, legislation in 2007, and pledged to SEIU members to make it the law of the land when I'm president of the United States. Obama's fierce support from the SEIU rank and file convinced Stern and the union bosses, who had favored Edwards, to delay a primary endorsement. Obama rocked the House, one union official admitted. 5 months later, after Edwards abandoned his campaign and Obama was battling Hillary Clinton for the nomination, the SEIU crowned its torchbearer. There's never been a fight in Illinois or a fight in the nation where our members have not asked Barack Obama for assistance and he has not done everything he could to help us, Andy Stern, the union's president, said at his February 2008 press conference announcing the decision. Stern put his membership's dues money where his mouth was. The SEIU Political Action Committee poured an estimated $80 million worth of independent expenditures into the campaign coffers of Democratic candidates in 2008, more than $27 million of which went to Barack Obama. The union proudly claimed that its members knocked on 1.87 million doors, made 4.4 million phone calls, registered 85,914 voters, and sent more than 2.5 million pieces of mail in support of Obama, in addition to sending SEIU leaders to seven states in the final weekend before the election to get out the vote for Obama and other candidates. SEIU's enforcers have set aside another $10 million to spend on unelecting any of its political beneficiaries who abandon their pledges to do the union's legislative bidding. The campaign money was raised by slapping an extra $6 per member fee on top of regular dues payments, which was funneled straight to the union's Political Action Committee. What major private company could escape scrutiny or criticism for forcing all of its employees to subsidize its political activities, whether they agreed with them or not? And what does it say about Obama's credibility as a reformer that the massive infusion of union dues into his campaign treasury didn't trouble him in the least?